Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. For most of us, a mistake made at work may cost a few dollars, lose a customer or a job, but won't be career-ending or life-threatening. Doctors aren't like most of us. If there's an error in treatment, medication, diagnosis, or surgery, the results can be harmful or fatal and may lead to a lawsuit, a loss of license, and the ability to practice.
Doctors have to be careful when admitting mistakes because of the threat of legal action. But suppose medical students receive training on how to make and admit mistakes. The ability to approach a patient or family member and speak calmly, sincerely, and openly about the outcomes of human error, because after all, doctors are human, is a trait that is essential to a compassionate, caring practice. Our next guest joins us to explain why medical schools need to teach doctors in training how to make mistakes. Dr. Neha Vapiwala is a vice chair of education, radiation oncology, and the advisory dean at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Her essay on this topic appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Dr. Vapiwala, thank you for coming on Take Care.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a tricky topic because there's so much history and there's so much culture behind the belief that doctors are infallible, that they don't make mistakes. And you are pushing against all of this cultural thinking. So why do you think medical schools should teach future doctors how to make and admit mistakes?
Well, I think you stated it perfectly, which is that there is this culture of perfection that is expected. And certainly, you know, I think for the public, when you go to a care provider and you're in a vulnerable position with illness of any type, you want to know that the team around you, and particularly the head of that team, which is often the physician, is in charge and is infallible. And I think that when we look to the basis of that behavior, oftentimes it starts with very high-achieving, eager, what we call type A students who enter medical school and really are trying to be the best in their specialty and in their profession. And sometimes being the best means you just don't have any room for error, no room for getting a 99 on that exam or anything less than perfect. And to be fair, that's often how these students got into medical school in the first place. So I think to understand the premise of our essay is to first step back and look at what gets people into the medical profession. And oftentimes it is this driving for being perfect and for not ever letting go or, you know, admitting to the possibility that they may not be in charge or be able to know everything at all times. And while that's an extreme, or may sound extreme, I think it often plays subconsciously into the interactions that physicians have with their colleagues and with their patients, where they have to be confident, they have to make decisions, sometimes with all the information, sometimes not, if the urgency of the medical care does not allow for it. And it's difficult later to then look back and say, you know, I should have just done it this way, because a lot of times there are no take-backs.
What you're saying also, it isn't just the culture, but it's the person, the doctor, the type of person. Mm-hmm. This person feels under pressure not to make mistakes. And when they do, they're letting themselves down, let alone how it might feel to them to express that to colleagues and patients.
Absolutely. And I would just say, you know, of course, these are general examples, and you may have certain personalities that differ, but the overall foundation of being in medicine often involves this sense of knowing as much information as you possibly can, having the most expertise that you possibly can. When a patient is seeking a physician, whether it's a surgeon or an internal medicine physician, you know, you're looking to go to the person who has the best record, the track record amongst other patients, the best reviews online, the degrees on the wall, and the number of cases and volume and expertise. And to get all of that, oftentimes the physician feels, you know, that this requires, again, a sense of being at the top of one's game. And with that comes very little room for having a less than perfect track record.
I want to talk about medical malpractice, because that's not what you are addressing. But I think it's important because it's become so prominent, I think, or talked about within medicine. Isn't the current thinking that when doctors are prompt in admitting mistakes and show compassion for the patient and family, that they're less likely to get sued for medical malpractice? So there's a little sensitizing going on. It's because of the financial thing, and that is not the point of your paper, and we'll get back to that. But I think we should differentiate why doctors are being urged to admit mistakes in terms of malpractice.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, to ignore the tort issues, the litigation issues, the financial implications would be to ignore a very important piece of the puzzle. But you're right. While that wasn't the focus of our piece, it is a very important driver in terms of why, once again, you make a mistake in the medical profession and it may follow you forever. As you said in your introduction, you know, every time you go to apply for privileges at a hospital, every time you go to renew your medical license, every time, honestly, that you face your colleagues, if you have had a malpractice suit brought against you, rightly or wrongly, it is this dark cloud that is virtually impossible to ever really shake. And that's just the external. Internally, what that physician might be struggling with as a result of having been named in a lawsuit, again, rightly or wrongly, can be very devastating to one's confidence, to one's self-esteem, and also their ability to actually talk about these issues because, again, it can be so isolating. And I think that what you alluded to earlier in terms of the importance of speaking up and being honest with your patients, there have been studies that have clearly shown that patients are far less likely to sue physicians whom they like. Now, that's a very simplistic way of saying who they like. Well, what does that mean? It oftentimes means a doctor-patient relationship in which the physician is thought to be honest, forthcoming, who communicates, who gives you eye contact, and who really establishes a relationship, you know, and the rapport that one would want in a doctor-patient team. And if you don't have that relationship with your patients, you are far more likely to be sued for the same event.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And today we're talking about a new way of thinking that medical schools should be helping doctors in training understand how to make and admit mistakes. This was an essay that appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, written by Dr. Neha Vapiwala, and she is a vice chair of education, radiation oncology, and the advisory dean at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Let's talk for a moment about the actual admission of making a mistake, because we've referenced the fact that we're no longer in that doctor is God phase, and now we're looking upon it as a team, a partnership. However, the doctor has the professional credentials, has the knowledge, has the authority, and it must be especially difficult when the doctor makes an admission of error because there is an emotional toll that the mistake has on the doctor. There's guilt, there's shame, the humiliation of having to admit that mistake. How is that for a doctor, and is that part of the training that you're looking for new doctors to have?
Yes, absolutely. What you articulated is really, to us, the foundation of the barrier. Many people think, again, it's a financial thing, or it's, you know, maybe the doctor just doesn't admit that he or she did something wrong and doesn't want to admit it because they feel that they're infallible. I think it's quite the opposite. I think that, you know, today's physician in today's era does struggle with and grapple with all of the technology and the knowledge and the advances in healthcare that we're supposed to keep up with in this environment of do more with less, seeing patients and dealing with complex problems in less time than they had before, perhaps with less support. You know, I think doctors are very actually acutely aware of areas in which they may have oversights or risk of oversights, and it's very much in the minds of hospitals. But when it comes to an individual grappling with, I think I've done something wrong, actually, I know I've done something wrong, what do I do next? I think it is blindsided of us to think that it's a simple matter of, okay, well, you have to follow the process and report what's happened. I think that while that good intention is there, the feelings of shame, of doubt, of will I ever recover from this, will my colleagues and my and my supervisors see me the same way? Will my promotion be compromised? And then, of course, there are the legal and other implications. But I think that fundamental to that, before you even get to that, is the self-loathing and to some degree, some of the social psychology aspects that we talk about in our essay, you know, the idea that, you know, forecasting error, that's a phenomenon in which you already imagine the worst case scenario for this patient. It kind of exaggerates the error to some degree. And so what might have been certainly an error with consequences takes on a whole other life where you immediately assume the worst case and that the patient may never recover. And thankfully, most errors that we're referring to are not that extreme. And there's also the idea of fundamental attribution error, where it's really internalized to an individual rather than to a process, that it's this something that I did wrong as opposed to what could have gone wrong here that caused this to occur and how might we prevent it for the next person. And taking that approach so that those around you aren't immediately asking who's at fault, but rather what transpired and how do we fix it for the future. And that kind of apologetic environment and non-judgmental forgiving environment, while it sounds logical and wonderful, is not really often how things go. And in the stressful moments and in the moments of somebody wanting to explain to the patient how this all went wrong, it's very easy to just sort of make it about a person and make it about that individual's failure to do something. And that can be really psychologically traumatizing and difficult to recover from for an individual who's used to being at the top of his or her game, at the top of his or her class. You know, how does this help them for the next time? It may not. It may just shame them into feeling like they don't want to talk about it.
And one of the things that you mention in your paper are, and you advocate for this, some medical schools are using paid actors to do role-playing with medical students to teach them how to respond to difficult and emotional situations. Would you describe how this works?
Absolutely. So standardized patient programs are thankfully something that many medical schools have already incorporated into their curricula. It can also certainly be used for medical student graduates who are in their residency training. But the idea is that you try to create scenarios in the form of, you know, these paid and well-trained actors who pose as patients. And in a proper scenario, you would actually have just the standardized patient and the student learner in a room that is being observed by a camera, and there are folks behind the scenes, usually faculty members who are observing and will later be able to provide feedback. And the standardized patient, him or herself, is also provided a checklist of things that he or she should give feedback on, such as eye contact, ability to communicate clearly, compassion that was demonstrated, certainly the technical aspects. So there's a variety of things one can test. And usually standardized patients have been used for very sort of technical aspects of basic communication and, you know, do you make eye contact and are you able to break bad news, for example, is a classic one. Another might be dealing with a difficult patient or culturally sensitive issues. But the disclosure of an error, the fundamental challenge of disclosing an error, because you can actually create a culturally awkward situation with an actor. But to create an error and create that stress level that comes when something goes wrong is very hard to simulate and mimic. So it's not going to be perfect. But we think that it's a place to start, because if the first time you're ever dealing with it is when it actually happens, you really don't know how you're going to respond. So we feel and we posit that if you at least expose students to this possibility in the best closest thing that you can to reality, that it's a start and that it's using tools that we already are using and already have in the medical school curricula to really force people to think about how they would walk into a room, look a patient in the eye, his or her loved ones in the eye, and say, here's what went wrong and here was my role in what went wrong and here's how we're going to address it. And I think that second piece of what happens next is also an area where physicians may sometimes not do well and grapple with. And the patient really just wants to focus on what happens next. And a lot of times, if you're still stuck in the guilt and shame phase, you can't move to the, well, let's remedy this and talk about options phase. And that's sometimes the thing that patients want the most. Yeah.
Well, the essay is called Why Medical Schools Must Teach Future Doctors How to Make Mistakes. It appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate your time.
Dr. Neha Vapiwala is Vice Chair of Education, Radiation Oncology, and the Advisory Dean at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania.